Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Hi, it's the Apparatus Architects here with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand from the Firehouse Expo here in Baltimore, Maryland. And on today's podcast, instead of the standard rundown, we are very privileged to have several representatives from the major apparatus manufacturers. And we're going to have a little roundtable discussion today on some safety-related issues and how they impact on apparatus design. So we'd like to introduce our esteemed panel this morning, starting with representing from American LaFrance, Keith Purdy, from the Crimson Fire Group, Jim Sommy, from Emergency One, Mr. Alan Hollister, from Pierce Manufacturing, Jim Featherstone, and from KME, Jason Whitmire. So I'd like to welcome each of you gentlemen.
Thank you very much for taking the time out and being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, this is our first shot at having a guest on a program, and Mike and I were very, very happy and fortunate that these gentlemen have taken time from their activities here at the Expo to spend an hour with us and with the audience so that we can go through some of the things that are going on here in the fire service in 2007. So with that, not that the apparatus trends here for 2007 are necessarily a reflection of brand new rigs or what's been going on, but it's somewhat disturbing that so far this year we're almost on a record pace, I believe, Mike, for the number of people injured and or unfortunately. How many fatalities are we up to apparatus-related?
We have 16 apparatus-related fatalities in the industry, and again, many of those have been ejected and killed. And the trend just keeps going on and on. Manufacturers tend to make the vehicles more safe and still we're missing the mark, and that in a lot of cases is a training issue.
Well, with that, we'd just like to know, with not specifically with respect to the stats that are so far that have occurred in 2007 this year, but obviously firefighter safety has been in the forefront here for the last number of years, particularly with the initiatives that the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation have embraced, and we're 3 to 4 years into that, and sometimes it's a little disturbing to see what the batting average is as a result of that. So just basic question is, with consideration to firefighter safety and things in we can do in the design process to improve and enhance the safety, I'm going to start out with Keith at ALF. What kind of considerations or what things are you planning on working on, or what initiatives to try to enhance and improve the safety aspects of your product?
We find and we believe that it continues to be a challenge that the SCBA inside the fire cab is conflictory with using your seatbelt. We're asking the crews to do multiple things. There's a lot of fluidity in the response. There is a dynamic environment where decisions need to be made quickly, and this is all happening while going down the road. In our case, we've been studying the use of the seatbelts, the seatbelt sensor systems, and we are working towards, as well as we know many of our other esteemed competitors are working towards, putting in safety systems and sensor systems to be able to alert us, a black box, if you will, that will indicate who is belted and what happened at the time of motor vehicle accident or some type of event. The other thing that we've been doing is working with aerial devices, and we've been putting lights in the walkway of the aerials and looking at enhanced lighting around those areas to try to enhance safety in that regard.
All right. Jim, I know that you have probably a unique perspective, having worked not only in the sales side very successfully for the last several years with the Pierce organization, but based on your background coming as a fire chief in a volunteer station in Fairfax County, where there's a lot of runs and a lot of activity, and it's not your almost everyday fire service. What kinds of things do you see, maybe even kind of unique perspective to the D.C. metro area, or things that people have embraced and what peers might be doing in that area?
Well, a couple comments, Tom. First of all, I think everyone would agree that all of the apparatus manufacturers over the last several years have devoted an awful lot of attention to safety as related to cabs, whether it's cab structural strength, larger braking systems, side rollover protection systems, roll stability systems, seatbelt on or off sensing systems. It goes on and on. But as Mike mentioned when he was doing his lead-in, I think we're at a point where maybe just one added technology or feature or option is not the answer. And there was a good point made about the SCBAs and the dynamic environment, et cetera. But I think that beyond that, quite frankly, and I speak to this from my fire service experience, past and current, it is to a great extent, it's not about SCBA, it's not about dynamic environments or anything like that. It's about attitude. And the attitude that a lot of people have is, it's not going to happen to me. We're not going to have that T-bone accident with another apparatus at an intersection. We're not going to roll over, etc. And they don't wear their seatbelts. It's as simple as that. And until we either affect a cultural change or, from a design and technology perspective, prevent the apparatus from moving unless people are belted, I think there's a threshold or a ceiling to what sort of success we're going to have. I think that's the reality of the situation.
Jim, I think that's a good perspective. Going back to San Diego over a year ago, where there was a big push from within the NFPA committee that appeared, it looked like they were going to try to put out a TIA to potentially remove SCBAs from the seats. And it was some discussions with Brother Mike and Gordon Routley from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and just some practical experiences that I had in the apparatus industry, and just take the tools and all the stuff that we want to put in cabs and look at a unit that I know had been designed to accomplish that, and then you go in the station 3 or 4 months later and here's the rabbit tool or the hydro ram, a pair of irons and a maul, and it's sitting on the floor of the cab. Why? Because it's a busy running station. After the guy's done that the third or fourth time for the day, he's not about to go back to the compartment you designed specifically to get that out. And you're right, that's an attitude. You go to the officer and say, why do you allow this? And the officer's like, well, just kind of let him do his thing, you know. So where does it start from?
Well, can I give you another example that has nothing to do with apparatus accidents? Look at the zillions of dollars that fire departments have invested in diesel exhaust extraction systems. And a lot of those systems require that a hose be hooked up to the exhaust. Visit the fire station, and of course, what do? They back the truck in, and after the truck's backed in and turned off, they hook up the hose. Well, it's completely defeated the purpose. And once again, it's the human element and the human factor that has to be addressed. In other words, you're gonna have fire departments and firefighters groups, you know, beating the drum to go out and buy these diesel exhaust extraction systems. And once again, they're just not going to get used. And of course, they're hooked up to the exhaust so that when they go to make the response, turn the truck on and go to leave, the exhaust system's actually turned on. So it's protecting an empty firehouse.
Yeah, a point well taken. And just to update you, after those discussions in San Diego a year and a half ago, some changes. Well, in those discussions, the mention was made of taking the SCBA out of the seats, and I came up with three reasons why that would be really, really good. But the overwhelming bad reason, and again, it's, you can call it a training issue or a cultural change issue or a leadership issue or a rule enforcement issue, but we know that there will be departments out there that if we put all the breathing apparatus in high side compartments, you're going to go to the station and you're going to find the SCBA back in a cab on the floor. And the pill for the solution has become worse than the problem itself now by doing that. And so there is a group that Gordon and I have head up to improve seatbelt safety, measure firefighters, which is an anthropometric study of firefighters. Right now, as we speak at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, there are about 8 or 10 firefighters being measured per day in our study. Early results of that study, and even before that, Roger LaCour, who works for Pierce Manufacturing, but who's also on the 1901 committee and is also associated with the Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association as well, solicited firefighters and fire departments from across the country to measure people by hand. And in that, those early measurements, we find that the standard industry cab that you all build is 89 inches from door handle to door handle inside. We have found out with firefighters in 2007 in bunker gear in the 95th percentile, they need a minimum amount of room of 95 inches. And so the math just doesn't work out. And you are going to find industry-wide that in the days and weeks ahead, that the day of putting 4 SCBA seats across the back of a custom cab are going to be gone for good because it just doesn't work and it's unsafe.
So, Jim, what types of things have you observed or are working on at Crimson with respect to the safety-related issues on the products that you folks build?
Well, there's two things that are happening if you look at it. There are things that are happening in response to NFPA 1901, because most people know there are things coming within that standard very likely. So there's a drive that people are trying to get ahead of the curve on the 1901. So if you're doing that properly and also reflecting safety, I think everybody's looking at systems for roll stability control. I mean, certainly we've had a large number of accidents related to particularly into tankers and high vertical center of gravity types of trucks. So electronic stability control, roll stability control are big hot buttons right now. Interior cab restraints, we've already talked about that a little bit. And I think also it's incumbent on manufacturers to pay a little more attention to egress and exit from apparatus, not only from the perspective of the cab entrances, but hose bed, areas around the truck where you're operating pump. Make sure you got good illumination, good stepping surfaces, good handrails. And that's obviously a challenge in design because there's a high level of opinion when it comes to certain fire departments about what safe entrance and exits are actually all about. So working closely with understanding how to do it properly and doing it safely as a focus of ours.
Good. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, it's one of the things that when Mike and I wander around the exhibit floor, one of my favorite things is you look at the rear hose bed areas and you try to climb up and down that even in street clothes. And that's the kind of thing. Part of it is driven by what we have done within the fire service to ourselves that years ago with T-shaped water tanks and 500 to 750 tanks, I'm 5'10". I was 5'10" back in 1973 when I was in College Park, Maryland, haven't grown up any. Mike, can you believe that? I haven't grown up any.
I can't believe
that. Well, at any rate.
You have gray hair, though.
You used to be able to stare into a hose bed when I was a youngster, right? Now, everybody wants a rescue engine. We're enclosing the ladders through the tank, alongside the tank, and the hose beds keep getting higher. So we put, legally, the NFPA compliant 64 square inch steps on there, put them on 18 inch centers. You'd be better off if you put one of those little small NASA mini rocket packs on your back and launch yourself into the hose bed at some point. So at any rate. All right, let's go on to our question number two. And this is, to me, very interesting. While Mike has had the good fortune, I mean, he's teaching some EVOC training up in Rockland, Maine, and the next week he's out at Edwards Air Force Base, which really concerns me because I'm thinking they're trying to recruit him to be a flight controller for the space shuttle there. You know, figure that out. At any rate, so, you know, people say, well, an engine is an engine is an engine. When you look at the style of apparatus that's used out in the Southern California area and compare that to what's used, for example, out in Long Island, there are some similarities, but there's a fair amount of changes or challenges as well. So it seems that each area of the country kind of has almost a little prevalent design, or areas within a particular state have a design. And I was just wondering, you know, what does your company do to address the different market demands in the areas where you folks produce the product? So Alan, you know, that's certainly got to be a challenge there. And from an engineering and marketing perspective, you know, guy in Southern California wants the short wheelbase, everything packaged, tight little compact rig, and then you go out to someplace and we'll beat up my own home state, New York, and the first thing they tell you is, we need a 10-man raised roof cab, you know, and so how do you work on something like that?
Now, this is certainly a difficult challenge. In fact, you don't even have to go across the United States to find that challenge. Within the area that I cover, which is the Northeast, there's a great diversity between the types of apparatus that various departments would like. You know, from, again, the Long Island fire apparatus to apparatus that's used in Maine or upstate New York or Philadelphia, you know, there are all some differences there. And it's a very difficult challenge, I think, for us and perhaps for all manufacturers as well. You know, we're trying to do a number of things. One is to meet the customer demand, but at the same time, and I think we're going to get into this question later on, we're trying to create or manufacture apparatus that is affordable as well. And you have conflicting things here. If you're trying to be all things to all people, yet at the same time manufacture a product where you can have some repeatability and gain some efficiencies in your manufacturing process and keep your labor costs down, it's a difficult challenge to make. So what we try to do is we try to take a look at the majority of what is being purchased out there, and we try to design apparatus that will meet what the majority is doing.
Okay, thanks. Now, Jason, one of the things I know that KME has done is only because Mike and I had the opportunity to see it out in San Diego several times, about the large contract that KME has with the Los Angeles County Fire Department, that you folks offered that same basic spec as, I guess, a tag-on or a consortium add-on. And I thought that was kind of an interesting concept that for people in the California area. I don't know how much influence that organization has on other people's purchasing practices, but certainly out east, if you go down here in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area, maybe not by manufacturer of rig, but people will talk about a DC-style engine, and right away that's connotating a low hose bed, low cross lay, short wheelbase, not one of these, you know, 42-foot, you can't describe it, barges. But you folks apparently had a leg up there on that. So I was just curious as to how, in particular, that program worked and what the acceptability of somebody outside of the West Coast area tagging onto a rig like that, or what other things KME is doing to help you out in that area.
Well, times have changed. Typically, in the past, you would expect to do a contract for someone like in LA County, and you'd see add-ons on the West Coast. It's a apparatus that works well for them. They all do the same style of firefighting, so it works well, and you expect that to go up and down that coast and just stay there. But times really have changed. One of the trucks that we have on the show floor here today is from Long Island, and it is an LA County add-on. It's almost identical to what LA County is doing. I think one of the big things that we found is a lot of work went into that contract based off of the KISS principle. Everybody's looking, we have all these newfangled things in the industry that really make things easier, but the more technology you put into it, the more problems you can have in the long run. So they've looked at, let's try and keep it simple and get things down and dirty to what we really need. Get rid of some of the fancy stuff and really make an apparatus that works for the firefighter on the fire ground. As we've done this, it's spread across the country. We've shown that apparatus all across the East Coast now, and a lot of departments have begun to accept it. It really has caught the eye of some people to see how we can all work together and share ideas. Probably the biggest thing that we've concentrated on is looking at each other and saying, okay, what do you do that you need for your area, and what do you do just because you've done it for so many years? Are there certain things that you've just done this over and over and over, so you continue to do it, but you don't really need to do it? And we've tried to design things out and design other things in to try and help someone work on things that really share ideas and things that work for everyone as a whole.
Do you think that might be cost-driven as well? If we can simplify the process, and I hate to use the word cookie-cutter rig, but get some similarities where you can not necessarily mass-produce them, but produce them without a lot of change, certainly that has to reduce the cost in the overall project, correct?
Certainly, but to an extent. I think in the chassis end of it, that's very capable to do. You can get to a point where you can say, okay, this chassis is manufactured now and all the bugs are worked out and all the designs are, everyone's had an input into it, and now we can save money because we can mass produce something that everyone's going to be happy with. It's when you get into the back end that really doesn't still apply. You still have some people that want a two-stage pump, some people that want a single-stage pump, some people that want the ladders enclosed like you talked about, Tom, some people that want them on the outside. That part of it, I think we're still resigned to the fact that we just have to design for what you need and what works for you. But certainly there are cost savings to be had if everybody's looking at the same thing.
Very good.
I think one other thing quick, just to back up a second, I think a very important point was missed on your first subject. And we talk about the seat belts, and we talk about the safety we've all designed into our cabs, the testing we've all gone through. That's great, and that's happened industry-wide, and I think we're all faced with it. We all kind of have similar solutions. The biggest thing I think that we're missing the point on is speed kills. And nobody's really doing anything. There's no way we're going to get a firefighter to say, okay, yeah, limit my apparatus to 40 miles an hour, and I'll buy that and I'll accept it. Well, no, then the next apparatus down the street from a different manufacturer goes 50, and this guy goes 60. And this guy, I run out an interstate, I need to go 70. I think the speed is what's killing most of these firefighters. You can take a firefighter in a cab, he can have all the protection he wants, but our cabs aren't tested when he's doing 75 miles per hour down an interstate and slams into something that may be coming at him even faster than 70 miles per hour. That's one of the areas that we've started to look at to see, is there something we can do, maybe through NFPA, through the government, something to start limiting the speeds of these apparatus.
Jason, thanks. Jim, I've read part, but arguably not all, of the 1901, some of the submissions that have gone into the committee with the pending revisions. And I thought that I had read something, although I can't speak exactly to the status of it, that there was a proposal to limit the speed of apparatus. And I took it that this was across the board, all vehicles, to either 68 miles per hour or the maximum rated speed of the tire, whichever is less. Can you amplify on that at all?
That proposal was submitted. I can't specifically recall amongst the 250 we went through whether that one was actually accepted at committee level. There was considerable discussion, and there has been over time, about fire service ratings for tires and various components on the truck. And there was a push, certainly, to limit it, but I can't remember.
Okay, I'm just be one interesting thing we'll just run down. Just about every fire apparatus manufacturer, of how we support the dealers and the folks out there, use either a standard software system or homegrown system to develop the specifications. And I know in the case at least of a couple of the manufacturers that I've been affiliated with in the past, if it's the don't ask, don't tell, built into that base spec, it starts out as top speed is. Way back in the day when things, to go to Jason's point, things were a lot clearer. It used to have a ratio, and somebody would actually have to figure that out and decide whether we're putting a 488 or a 390 in there. Now it's just top speed is. And I know in a lot of the base specs, it comes out, if you don't ask the question, it starts out at 65 miles an hour. So we'll just go run down and start with Keith at LaFrance. In the LaFrance spec system now, what's the starting speed until you ask the question?
The starting speed is 65 miles an hour. You can make suggestions and recommendations, but the issue remains that the components you choose, as Mr. Salmi was indicating, the components you choose, specifically the tires, will really dictate what engineering will release as the final governed speed. And the logic behind that is you don't want to exceed any component that you have placed by your choice into that system. And that is the safety system built into the spec.
Okay. Jim?
It's 65 as default. Interesting comment. We had a customer recently receive a truck, and basically what they set up was a 45 mile per hour top end without a special shift process at the pad, where you had to basically go to a select mode and then go to the top gear, which would then take you up to 65 miles an hour. So, and it was a way for them to control where they were going to go on the top end speed, and you have to really make a conscious decision that you wouldn't automatically roll through that gear set to get to the top end.
And I think what's interesting about that concept is that now you can hold somebody accountable. You were driving it, you pushed the button, you got in a wreck. Why? Okay,
absolutely.
you can ask the question, because it just didn't do that. You weren't going on this run and got wound up in the moment, and all the other excuses or whatever you want to call them that occur, but now you consciously had to go and push a button, the fast button, that you were going to go fast. Now, if something happens, defend that behavior.
Right. Alan.
Yeah, our default speed is 65 miles per hour. Now, I am somewhat encouraged that we are getting more and more requests from departments to govern that speed lower than that, you know, to go to 50 or 55. On the other side, also a little disturbing that we're getting some requests to actually exceed that, you know, where they would like to see the speed going up to 70 miles an hour, which again goes back to that cultural change and training issues that we've been talking about.
Yeah, Jim, I know in your area, I mean, you're talking about a very, very dense urban area, and even in some jurisdictions, if the engine company, Mike, I got to use that Maryland expression, you know, wagon goes out and staying in the first due area, 35 to 40 is fine, but then they get out on the highway, and even if the unit was governed at 70, they're the slowest thing out there, and now they become the target, and it becomes another, turns around and becomes another whole issue. So what do you see to this?
A couple of things. First, to go to Jim Salmi's point, that the mode buttons on the transmissions have become increasingly popular, and as was mentioned, it requires the conscious decision to open up that top gear. About a month ago, I had a customer ask me, a fleet customer, if the mode button could be remoted to the officer's side of the cab. In other words, where you talk about accountability, where in effect, the decision to open up the top 15 miles an hour rests with not the driver, but the officer. I know lots of officers who like the mode button because they can watch the guy's finger go for it, and he can tell them, don't do that. And as I say, this one customer took it a step further. And of course, the answer I got back was, yes, it can be done. So I really see that concept of the conscious decision to open up the top speed as being something that a lot of people are looking at, and it might extend beyond the driver to the officer.
Great point. It was always kind of interesting to me to see departments that would inquire, you know, the now almost standard, can we supply an officer side speedometer? And it was interesting, in a lot of those same jurisdictions, the officer wouldn't think of saying, we're not releasing the maxi brake until everybody's seated and belted, but I just kind of want to have a clue as to how fast we're going. So it's nice to have all those safety things, but again, Jim, it goes to one of your opening comments. It's accountability, and if I'm driving for Mike, are we really looking out for one another? Is he going to let me play cowboy on a day if I decide I want to play cowboy on a 24-hour shift?
Who's the captain of the ship?
Yeah.
And you know, that we always talk about this paramilitary analogy in the fire service. Well, you know, reminds me of the story of when one of the aircraft carriers was pulling into San Francisco for a port call, and they ran it aground. The captain of the ship was down in his quarters shaving. And when he was interviewed later, he said, when I felt that shudder, I knew my career was over. Because in that model, who is ultimately responsible and held accountable for that ship and the actions of 6,000 people? It's that captain. And in the fire service, we talk that all the time. And the question becomes, if the guy is the captain of the ship, so to speak, even though it's not an aircraft carrier, where does that accountability lie? And I think you use the term cowboying. A lot of times that officer is just, you know, he's along for the ride. He's the designated siren blower and radio talker, as opposed to being in charge. And just to go to one of the other points you made about this whole issue of top speed, we have to remember this country is not a monolith. And I don't know, you know, a lot of the people sitting around here, we're all East Coasters. And we want to talk about 45 or 65, et cetera. Imagine being the chief of some department in Montana where the first due goes for 80 miles and where he's got huge wide open roads. He needs to be able to make time. And to make time, he needs to have some speed. And you know, we have to remember this market is in so many respects, geographically, culturally, et cetera, it's not monolithic. It's like the country, it's very diverse.
Yeah, good point, Jim. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I, we went down out to the Winchester area of Virginia, coming down from Buffalo. So you start out at 55, you go to 65, right? You get into West Virginia, yeehaw, it's 75. And even at, I was doing like 77 miles an hour, and I felt like I was the head pin at the end of the bowling alley. You're gonna get run over, right? Then as soon as you get over back into Virginia, you know, now you drop back down again. Good point. Jason, what do you think?
I think like all the other manufacturers said, we start out around 65 with the speed. And of course it has to be based on the tires or the weakest link, whatever the weakest link is in that whole system has to govern the top speed. But coming back to the comments that we've heard about the diversity across the country, a good point. My concern is that company in Montana who has a 3,000-gallon tanker, who has a guy that drove the truck once in the last year, and now he's going 70 to make up time, and he rolls it. That's my concern. I understand that there are times where you need to go faster, but unfortunately, the reality in the fire service is that they're not all trained the same. They don't all have the same abilities. We don't all have the same abilities, I should say. And we have to look at that instead of being reactive and saying, okay, well, who was the officer who made that decision? We need to be more proactive and say, how can we prevent this in the first place?
Yeah, I remember we worked on a book for the federal government for FEMA and the U.S. Fire Administration. It was called The Safe Operation of Fire Department Tankers. And there were a couple manufacturers represented there, and we got into a really heated discussion. It's my view that 1,500 gallons of water on a single axle should be it. And he said, well, we can put 2,100 gallons of water on a single axle. That may be true, and you can do that safely, but a lot of times the technology that you offer us outpaces our ability to train people to drive these things in a safe and efficient manner, just based on what you said. If you're in a firehouse with five different apparatus and you live 3 miles away in the volunteer sector, there may come a time in a year where you may not even drive all the trucks to the fire. And so it could become long periods of time before you get behind the wheel of that. And you know, as manufacturers yourself, you can make trucks fleet orders, LA, Milwaukee, some big orders that you have had, Phoenix for American LaFrance, and you can build 60 pumpers, and every one of them will have idiosyncrasies that are unique to that particular unit. And so the idea of, well, we'll train one guy on one and that'll do it, that's not necessarily the case either.
It's interesting the differences in even the larger career departments, particularly those where the driving position is not a dedicated position, or in some cases it's a position that they bid on, or it's a rank above, a firefighter two or a master firefighter, whatever the local description is. And you go into these jurisdictions, Mike and I, and just say, well, who's driving today? And it ranges from, in some cases, the logical, well, it's the senior guy on a shift. It's his to refuse. In other cases, you hear people say, we rotate every day. So if they're working 24 72s, every day you're getting another driver, which is great to kind of blend that experience out. But then it goes, how much do you do this? In individual volunteer departments, even if you're really active and a station's running 400 or 500 calls a year, how many times are you going to drive? And if each piece of apparatus is just a little bit different, how good are you really going to be, if you only drive a couple times a month, or you drive on meeting night or the drill night or something like that? It's under somewhat controlled conditions. If you didn't go run the fire call and it all hits the fan, that's when we want to make sure that we want to do something.
This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. We're at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, in July of the summer 2007 with our manufacturing guests. We're going to take a quick break. I'd like to thank Task Force Tips for sponsoring us again today, and we'll be right back after this message.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Okay, welcome back to Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. This is Mike Wilbur.
Tom Shand.
And we are here today with representatives from the manufacturing of sector. Can you introduce our guests again?
Sure.
Please?
Once again, those people, if you're just joining us, we have today Mr. Keith Purdy from American LaFrance, Jim Sommy from Crimson, Alan Hollister from Emergency One, Jim Featherstone from Pierce, and Jason Whitmire from KME. And just prior to the break, we were finishing up a discussion talking about the apparatus trends and safety-related issues, particularly with respect to top speeds of apparatus, and Keith wanted to comment in on that.
Yeah, one final thought before we went to the break, and one thing that we were discussing was top speed. We also spoke about the driving characteristics. As a trend or as something that I've seen, and as Mr. Featherstone was suggesting during the break, many of us get to witness what we see both at the fire department level and then within the organizations themselves. One trend that I've noticed, and I really believe strongly should be getting more national attention than it does, is the driving simulator. I've seen them in use. I've seen where you can take crews that really aren't familiar with the driving characteristics of a vehicle, put them in a safe environment to control that technology, and really bring them up to a higher level of understanding the dynamic that they're going to experience when they get out on the road. With the electronics and with these simulators getting better and better all the time, they're actually able to plug in and make that a pumper or an aerial, whatever driving characteristic you want to see. And it provides a classroom, a controlled setting to audit, check, and really authenticate what that driver's capable of doing and also find weaknesses before they're out on the road. It doesn't grab the attention it should, but as a suggestion as a manufacturer, it certainly is a support technology that works well in other markets.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that because I actually had done some consulting for some simulator companies. I believe it's an up-and-coming technology. As the price of the apparatus increase and as the price of the simulators decreases, they find better and more unique ways to build these and reduce labor costs and order parts in bulk and whatever they can do. We need to appeal to the firefighters of today and tomorrow. And most firefighters that we have now are playing video games. And not that we equate simulators to video games, but you are appealing to their way of learning. All of us that are on this panel learn from books. And now learning is computers and technology like that. And I think that in order to keep pace with the students, with the firefighters that are going to drive these things, I truly believe that simulation is a wave of the future, without a doubt. And I think that's an excellent point. And of course, the military has realized that for years and years. You're not going to put, you know, a 22 or 3-year-old kid behind the controls of a $26 million jet. Well, I think the parallel certainly is we're not going to put 18, 20, 22-year-old kids behind the wheel of a $1 million or $1.3 million aerial tower either. And I think it's price-based, but I think as the price comes down in them and they become more available, I think that's going to be an important place as far as training.
It's kind of unfortunate to me, Mike, that we sometimes have to look at and serious accidents or fatalities have to occur almost on a periodic basis to be a wake-up call to the fire services that with all the other training scenarios and requirements that you have managing, whether it's a volunteer, a career, or a combination organization, of all the different benchmarks that you need to hit during the course of the year, and considering that driving, while it's very important and you've devoted a lot of your time to that, is something that is unique and significant, that if you have a four-person unit, well, it's only that training component only affects that one individual. And a lot of times we just haven't given enough advantage and requirements towards even the requalification of folks. And we noticed that when we were working in Montgomery County over the Training Academy earlier this week, that they've now very aggressively embarked on a program where you just don't qualify as, quote, a technician or a chauffeur on a typical rig in the service. You've got to qualify on the piece of apparatus that you're actually operating by make and model. So,
yeah, that's true. One of the questions that I always ask when I lecture, why is it the things in the fire service that we use the least, we train on the most, and the things that we use the most, we train on the least? The next fire call that anybody in the United States goes to, they may or may not stretch a hose line, they may or may not take the hearse tool off, they may or may not put up a portable ladder, but each and every run that the fire department embarks on, somebody needs to get behind a wheel of something and take that in a safe manner and get the equipment and the crew there to the scene safely. and yet the training hours devoted to that, which is the most important task, are far less than some of the other things that we train on. And it just, to me today, mystifies me that that's still the case after all this time.
Well, we know over the course of years, sometimes because of these accidents and injuries, or worse yet, fatalities we've been talking about, or a lot of cases just because people in the, no disrespect to Jim, but people have that inner beltway mentality. We like to develop regulations and everything. But there are things that, whether industry related within the 1901 committee or coming out, we all know that every manufacturer, engine manufacturer, specifically the three major engine manufacturers we use, had a significant challenge, you know, over the last couple of years to meet the 2007 EPA regulations that impacted a lot of chassis design of things that we're now working with. The 1901 committee is in the public comment phase. So, well, what types of things do we see? And we know in 2010 there's another round of emission concerns that we're going to have to face. What types of things do you see coming down the pike, either positive or negative, that we might have to be working with in the future, and how that might impact the kind of rigs that we're working on? Keith, what's...
As always, the question will have multiple answers, but for fleet buyers, especially out on the West Coast, emission standards and regulations, eventually we believe fire departments and fire trucks specifically may not be exempt. Compressed natural gas, alternative fuels, is going to have to be a reality at some point. What that point is, I personally can't speak to. But we are seeing interest with many fleet buyers who are attempting to get ahead of the curve and comply to those regulations, or prepare to comply to those regulations. We are seeing that compressed natural gas is a solution. There is enough data out there in other vocational markets similar to fire apparatus, and it does lend itself to some reengineering to apply that technology. And that will probably continue moving forward.
Good, thanks. Jim, I know that you being a sitting member on the 1901 committee, and several times they have gotten a standing ovation over some of the work they've done, and in some cases it's been maybe considered to be less than plausible by some of the users. So what kinds of things, what insight can you lend with respect to where 1901 might be going for things that we're going to be looking towards in the future?
First comment is that I usually get those things that people don't like pointed out to me on a regular basis, but the ones they do like generally don't come up all that often.
Yeah, we'll make sure at the end, Jim, that we give out to the listeners, give out your email address so you can get some more of the zingograms there to start your days off.
Obviously, one of the hot topics right now is the issue of rear chevrons. And, you know, right now, as the proposal's going forward, we're looking at, you know, a requirement for chevron striping, alternating colors on the backs of vehicles. So that is currently in the standard. It's gotten a lot of discussion, been back and forth a number of times, but it's a requirement, and obviously that flies against some of the, you know, ease of using tread plate and diamond stuff on the back. So that's a big one. Also, the push to either electronic stability control or tilt table testing of apparatus is another very major issue at hand. And a lot of it has been driven by the tanker rollovers, particularly in terms of like vertical center gravity and rollover. Then the question is, well, if it's good for a tanker, why isn't it good for a rear mount platform or a pumper? So I think it's sitting pretty strongly right now in the standard. Seatbelt warning systems are also very likely to stay in. It kind of ties to several of the points that we've been making. If, in fact, you can write standards to make the product safer and safer and safer, but at some point in time, there has to be some personal accountability as well. So from a manufacturer's perspective, we have to protect ourselves from product liability issues as well. So we have a duty to design to protect people and adhere with the standards. But in doing so, we also tend to drive the cost of vehicles upward as well. So,
well, that's where we were going with one of the other things, and maybe Alan, you'd feel free to comment on this. I'm going to date myself somewhat, but going back in history, I remember the first time I heard about a $50,000 pumper. I drove myself, and actually it was my mom and dad's car, I drove 2.5 hours because I wanted to see what the heck a $50,000 fire truck was going to look like. And back in the day, you know, that was an exorbitant amount of money. Ladder trucks hadn't even approached $100,000. During Mike's and my career, there have been certain financial benchmarks that when the first $250,000 pumper was like, oh my God, $250,000.
Well, now, we'll look at what the specs that we just got that you called up a few months ago and asked for a pumper. The most expensive pumper that this manufacturer ever built is not too far from my house at $602,000. Not for a rescue pumper, but just for a standard pumper. They didn't leave one option out that I could see.
You know, I think sometimes, particularly, I'd be critical in my own background, in the volunteer segment, we can use as a crutch, well, this was mandated, or we had to have this, or we had to have this, to glance over the fact that when you go to your bean counters, whomever they might be, and they say, but we had 450 budgeted, and you're showing up with something that's 527, and you're like crying, like, I gotta have this. That, you know, how much of this do you really feel is driven by the consumer versus how much is stuff that's driven by the manufacturing sector, whether it's, we talked about briefly, with standardization or the impact of the regulations and trying to balance those things out. You know, how much sticker shock do you see people really getting as you're going through the process?
I think that, I guess to answer your question, I think a lot of that is the ancillary equipment that we're putting on trucks. I think most manufacturers are really trying to keep the cost of their apparatus down in one aspect or another. But we have lots of things that we like to put on trucks, you know, compressed air foam systems, hydraulic duals, the lightings that is available out there from the various manufacturers, whether you go from strobe lights to LED lights. We're putting all of these things on trucks today that increase the cost of the truck substantially. And sometimes you put so much stuff on the truck, it doesn't even really play well together, you know, which causes some other concerns as well on it. So I see more of it coming from, I guess, the consumer part of it, driving the cost up, saying that I've got to have each and every one of these little things that are available to me today.
Okay. Jim, when you're when you go out and working with the department, how often do you find if they're developing a spec for what you would ostensibly consider to be a standard pumper, but then they're mentioning, well, we need a 20K generator and we're going to throw, you know, hey, if we throw a light tower on the roof, how much is that really going to raise our overall height? How many times do you find that somebody is asking as they're throwing these things on, as we might as a consumer, if we went in to go purchase a car, there's the proverbial sticker price. It has certain things packaged. It was always interesting to me. One of the cars that I purchased at one point, I definitely wanted to have ABS brakes, but believe it or not, they had that package with leather seats and the moonroof. You know, and he said, that's the convenience package. So that's convenience package so that if the ABS brakes don't work, the moonroof opens and I eject myself. I'm like, I couldn't quite figure that one out. But how savvy do you find the people as they're going through to say what the individual costs are, or as I find a lot of times, is they're not really interested in the whole cost of the meal until you push, they've already consumed the product and you push the ticket in front of them and they go, wow, I didn't know I spent that much.
I think that in general, at least in the markets that I work in, and I would say that this is regardless whether it's in the urban areas or the more suburban and rural areas, I would say that today's customer is more savvy than they've ever been. There's more access to information through publications, the internet, and a variety of other sources. So people know what's out there and they know what's available. I also think that consumers today have a tendency to be performance and capability oriented. If they're going to go out and buy a new piece of apparatus, they want performance out of it. So I don't know that people are necessarily focused, as you just said, on the individual options, but sometimes you do get the head snapping effect when once they've laid out all of this stuff, they find, wow, I didn't realize it was going to be that much. But then imagine, as I'm sure most people here have done, sitting with a committee for 2 or 3 hours and trying, maybe even longer, and trying to get that number down. And after a couple, 3 hours of mud wrestling, that $600,000 price tag is now down to 590 or something like that. I remember one situation very distinctly a few years ago with a customer, and they're trying to do that, and the treasurer of this fire department was a CPA, a woman who's not a firefighter, and she sat around and watched this exercise unfold for about 3 hours, and we had literally moved the price down by $10,000.
And she said, I love you guys, but this whole evening has been a waste of time. What difference does it make? Because you're not going to get beyond just trimming a few things. So they looked at her and said, can we afford it? He says, well, if we can afford $590, we can afford $600. It's just not that big a difference. Yeah. And you asked about the cost of apparatus. Barring a significant economic downturn in the country that forces departments to make decisions they really don't want to make, I don't see the cost of apparatus coming down. I see people wanting more. I see the impact of government regulation and the NFPA standard, and I see that it's going to keep increasing. The other thing is, we've talked about the ability to mass produce. As a firefighter or in business, I've been associated with this game now for 35 years, and people have been talking about a mass-produced fire truck for that long and longer. And in my opinion, barring some huge change in the customer base, which I don't see, that's not going to happen. And ultimately, in a country like ours, businesses, and we're all representatives of businesses, we're customer-facing. It's a market-driven process. And if the market demands customization and the market demands that people want it just this way, then to survive and prosper, you have to do what your customers want you to do.
Yeah, there's good point, Jim. There's two different dynamics that I see, and I guess maybe it's based on, you know, whether it's size of the department or their operational characteristics, but when Michael and I go out to go teach classes, and people sometimes broach a subject that, particularly in a smaller, maybe semi-rural areas, that just, you know, new apparatus has gotten beyond their means to acquire stuff. Is it, if you take operationally two of the largest departments on opposite ends of the coast, if you took a New York City engine company, right, and dropped that into Los Angeles, it's built by the same manufacturer, and then did the reverse, took an LAFD engine and put that into New York, just because of what you were alluding to, the operational characteristics of the department. It's got the same nameplate on the side, the same brand of pump, maybe the same tires, and after that, they're pretty radically different, built specifically to what that department operates. And you can take it to their aerial ladders as well. What's interesting to me is that the market, going back in some period, just for all of the manufacturers that are represented here, you folks have whatever you may call it from your marketing perspective, the fully custom unit, where you start as a base unit and, you know, the customers throw everything in a kitchen sink at us, but you each all have a more modest, option limited product. How successful has that particular product been? Or have there been, I've dealt with people from that have come from outside the industry, but much more smarter than myself with a marketing perspective, and there would always be, well, you start off with this low base end unit that starts out at, you know, the $189,000 special, and then you upsell them into the Wonder Wagon. And I just have never had that experience, maybe because of the types of departments I've dealt with. They already had their mindset is, this is what you want, and you know, you couldn't turn a cream puff into a cream pie no matter how hard you tried. So Jason, I know you people have it. It's amazing to me that KME, all the different offerings, and I think even in your product literature you say over 300, you know, cab options. So I'm like, whoa, you know, where do you start here? So how successful is that whether you're going over to the full custom side or find that department that because of their price point or what they want, that you can kind of lead off with the other product that you have in your offerings?
It's not. Most customers are exactly what you said. You'll get a customer who says, you know, I want to take that base unit, that low-end, run-of-the-mill, this is what we want, $189,000, and now I want to add every option, and eventually they're pushing that low-end unit all the way up over the high-end unit. So it's very difficult to do that. It comes down to trying to talk to a department, find out what do you need versus what do you want. We want to carry 3,000 gallons of water, but have you looked and figured out what kind of water flow you need to put out a fire in your district? Can the area handle a 3,000 gallon tanker coming through? What do you really need to do the job versus what do you want to do the job? That's probably one of the biggest challenges. The other thing, back on your talk of what's driving the prices, absolutely, we're customer driven and the customer drives the price. But right now, today, I think safety is one of the biggest things driving the price. We're looking at more and more safety things, and it's a good thing, and we really do need it. But between government regulations, I mean, the biggest priced impact that we've seen in the apparatus industry in the past year is the engines going up for your new EPA compliance. So to get through those things, we're going to see another jump in apparatus pricing. Seatbelt sensors are a great thing. They cost money. Rollover systems are a great thing. They cost money. The concern is when you sit down with the committee who says, well, is it the rollover system or the rotoray? Which do we want to put on the truck? That's when you really get nervous and say, guys, we got to look at what's really important to you.
That's when we roll out Jim's CPA and go to price of the rotaries in venereal. We're throwing that's in. Jim, it's interesting to me, just go back. It appears to me that it seems to have been in particularly very successful with, I guess, their contender series of product. And interesting that you see even a lot of the Department of Defense installations, the Navy in particular, buying the contender series. And sometimes the mindset as well, if you're at a career firefighter and you're running off of that kind of rig at work, and then you go back to your volunteer station at night and they're trying to design, once again, the more expensive unit. What's your perspective there as to how that interacts when you're working with a customer?
Well, a couple of different observations. First, as you correctly state, Pierce has been phenomenally successful with this contender line, far more successful than they'd ever, I think, possibly imagined. They now produce several hundred rigs at that facility every year. I think, though, just observing it from the sales perspective, that one of the things that's made it so successful is that it started out as a program with a couple of different models and about 300 or 400 options, if that. And now it's up to a whole family of products and thousands of options. So I think the success of it has been the ability to grow the product line, grow the option content, but still maintain manufacturing efficiencies and keep the price down. But it all goes to the point of this love-hate relationship that the fire service has with cost versus capability. As I say, Pierce's budget-focused line has been successful because they can offer hydraulic ladder racks and sophisticated foam systems and things like that on the quote-unquote program truck. So what you see then is that even for the most budget challenge customer, this interest in purchasing capability or the line I use, some customers I can envision them saying, I may be broke, but I'm not quite that broke.
Good point. Keith, I know when you're one of your hobbies is in the automotive industry and looking at how those folks take different option content, things and either put them individually or put the packaging. How successful, in your experience, has it been for American LaFrance or just industry to take, rather than somebody saying, for example, I want the high side compartments on the right-hand side, and the organization has said, well, we're going to package that with this, this, and this. Does that seem to make the selling or the delivery process of the product to the customer easier, or does it make it more difficult that they're looking, well, I like two of the three things, but I don't need that third thing, and it forces you out of the program?
That's exactly right. Pre-packaging is a difficult, very difficult program to deploy and find success. Most customers in this market, and Mr. Featherstone had said earlier, we are customer driven, we are customer centric. Many customers coming into this buying and acquisition process are looking for what they want. They've defined their needs, performance based or whatever. And when they approach that market, they are willing to look at what you've prepackaged or what you have decided works well for your production. They're still going to want it their way, or at least they're going to raise the question of what can I do to get it my way. That sets up balance issues whether you're actually ready to perform that function or not. And with any prepackaging, it's hit and miss. Sometimes you're very, very successful. Sometimes you get a majority of it, but you've got to figure out how to do the rest, whether that's done aftermarket or whatnot. And it is not, at least at this point, it's not an easy proposition. I would like to also add that between trade shows and internet sales and advertising and magazine sales, most of the programs you see and most of the packaging you see is really meant to meet a customer's interest somewhere. But often that customer is just trying to make contact with you, and you're still going to have to sit down at that firehouse or wherever, and you're going to lay a vehicle out, typically using a blank sheet of paper.
Let me ask this question. Do you think that, I think, I know, I see sometimes that we in the fire service have almost become spoiled, that there's literally nothing that almost can't be done, and that perhaps some more cooler heads should prevail at times, if that makes any sense at all, that we're just, it just grows like an amoeba, it seems, in order to satisfy the customer. And it seems like sometimes we in the fire service as a customer don't even know what we want.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I've actually sat in pre-construction meetings saying, sir, or to the committee, I understand completely what you want here. Here's why I don't think it's a good idea. You know, and try to approach it from a tactical or a practical approach. And oftentimes soliciting arguments about that, you know, and then and coming to the point where, well, we are customer centric. I understand your point. We'll offer what you want. At the end of the day, if it doesn't perform, please don't come back to us and say, this is a terrible truck you built for us. Because that's something that does happen. We also have the interesting phenomena of suppliers that are a tier below the OEM selling products directly to the customer, which they then incorporate into the specifications. So as a manufacturer, we may not be very familiar at all with this component or system, but now it's in the bid package. So our ability to prove its reliability out ahead of time is also limited. So it really can put us in a kind of a funny position there when we try to make a good solid practical recommendation to do something that maybe isn't what they're asking for, because somebody else will come in and say, yes, we can do that, and we're not gonna push back.
Yeah, on Jim, that's a really good point. Specifically, I've had some personal experience with respect to the foam systems, and not to knock them, very, very good and very capable, but having to have a foam system component vendor go in and do a separate meeting with the department and tell them all the capabilities, show them the videotape, go through the PowerPoint program, and then Mr. Apparatus Builder shows up, who maybe is very competent and capable in installing foam systems, but not maybe never that particular brand, or that particular brand has had some running engineering changes between when it's first pitched to Chief Wilbur to say, this is why you want to do this, and then when you get the final product that shows up in the skid at your manufacturing site to find out that those components really don't look like they were originally proposed, and now I got to make this fit. Everything's been signed off, as you mentioned, in a pre-construction conference. We told them it was going to fit in the 48-inch pump box, and guess what? It doesn't now. So then it's the gentlemanly issue of punting and going from there. Jim.
The fire apparatus has gotten bigger and more sophisticated and all of those things. But I don't know that that's not a phenomenon that's confined to the fire service. Look at a house built 20 or 30 years ago. And look at the way houses are built now, how square footage has become more important, and all of the features people put into their houses. Or look at automobiles. Or another example, it's not an area that I know anything about as a consumer, but certainly when you look at them, look at the camper of the 1970s and this whole RV industry that has emerged that makes these huge, sophisticated vehicles that cost $150,000 or $200,000 or more. I think it's not so much unique to the fire service, but reflective of where the society is going in general as related to its sophistication and as related to its affluence. I mean, there are economic good times, the society is continuing to march on, and the fire trucks are getting jazzier. And if you look at just about everything else that everybody buys, from clothing to all sorts of consumer goods to houses, there's just more demand for nicer things.
Yeah, Alan.
Yeah, I'd like to, if I could, just go back to the talk about the program or limited option truck. You know, from my observation, that there's a market out there that still is willing to purchase a basic pumper, you know, a pumper that will, you know, carry water and put out fire on it. Then there's a part of the market that wants a little bit more than that. Then there's a part of the market that wants a highly customized truck. And so the challenge is how to meet all those market segments. You know, to come in with a truck that is a basic pumper, and Emergency One has been very successful with that for a number of years on it, then go into a transition to a truck that has a few more options, then transition into a truck that has, you know, that has high option capability.
Okay. Jason, with respect to the KME, the fact, like with the rest of the folks on the panel here, you folks, you know, have a wide range of product offerings and produce products for, you know, just about everybody in the United States. I know you do up in Alaska because we're up there a couple of years ago, and it's just, where long-term do you see the market going? Do you see them being more option content and to meet the need driven, as Jim would say, or do you see, at least in some geographic areas, where they're saying this is how much money we've got to spend, so let's throw as much stuff at it as we can to be able to meet that budget number?
Well, eventually we're going to run out of money. So eventually they're going to hit a wall, and they're going to have to start to say, these are the options we want, but these are the ones that we can really get. Because the cost keeps growing. I mean, the cost is growing rapidly for us in the industry, but the funding for the fire departments is not growing at that speed at all. I think the money that the government has put into the industry has helped a lot of departments, but it's going to run out eventually as well. So the program units are great. They're a great starting point. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy in the industry because we all battle against each other on these program units, and it's, okay, we've laid out this great program and it's got these options, but manufacturer B has added this option, so now manufacturer C is going to have to add this option. We're always trying to one-up each other, so at times we're our own worst enemies when it comes to these program units, but there's definitely a move in the industry, I think. You're seeing more departments that used to buy the tricked-out rig starting to consider the program unit, just as a starting point, then see what limited options are available to them.
Yep. Good observation. Well, just wrapping up here, Michael and I, we've been very fortunate to have the representatives from the five of the major manufacturers of the United States here to be able to give us some time this morning. And just before we wrap up, let's like to give a little, thank you sincerely to each of you five gentlemen. And
thank you very much. Yeah.
A couple of minutes just to wrap up with any parting comments, shots, or anything. So,
why don't we give each one of you a couple minutes where you can say some of your final thoughts?
Just like being on Meet the Press without Tim Russert staring you in the face.
So you want final thoughts on apparatus with no question being given? All fire trucks should be one color. They should all be one dimension. They should all be one size. No, I'm making this up.
Okay. Right.
There are people in the back. We need a defibrillator in aisle three.
Yeah.
No.
All right.
Really what we're seeing and moving forward in the industry, we're seeing that electronic systems, control systems, and diagnostic systems continue to improve. And the logic behind that is everything should become safer. There certainly have been growing pains as electronics become more prevalent in our industry, and I think we're beginning to see some benefits from that learning curve, and as we continue to move forward, we should see that we create safer vehicles that really makes the crew's job a lot easier.
Good. Thanks, Keith. Jim?
I think if you take the four questions at hand, they all wrap around a basic issue of economics and practicality. You know, safety is hugely important, but there's also economic values associated with going too far, with too much interlocking, too much control. And, you know, I'm kind of the common sense is a nice thing to have too every once in a while. So I think, you know, from a perspective of the apparatus, I think we're doing a great job of improving product. We're trying to keep costs under control. We have faced, you know, metals increases over the last few years that were unrivaled in prior times. So holding costs down, giving a good quality, safe apparatus is a challenge for a manufacturer these days. And I think we're all battling that challenge in a very competitive market. So we're all striving to do the best we can to meet that need.
Oh, good. Jim, thank you. Very, very good points to your comment that you made about the pre-construction conference. There's been several that I've been associated with recently that I would have been better off to show up in a striped referee shirt, you know, and it looked like the WWE no holds barred match, you know. Weren't any trash cans thrown, but short of that, it got pretty ugly at times. So, again, we sincerely appreciate your time. Alan Hollister, any final parting thoughts?
One of the aspects of safety that we haven't addressed here, and I'm not sure that we can have a whole lot of influence on it, and that's the responsibility of the public, and, you know, and how the public reacts to emergency warning signals. You know, there have been cases that I know our company has been involved in where we've been sued because the siren's too loud and we've been sued because the siren's not loud enough. And today's cars are manufactured so that it's very difficult, you know, to hear these warning signals or sirens. You know, if you've got your stereo cranked up pretty loud, which from my observation, that seems to be very frequent. on it. So it's, I'm not sure how much influence we can have on that, but there needs to be some exposure that needs to be put on somebody's priority list to help the public themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a point well taken. Yeah. Certainly offering driver training courses myself and going all over the country doing them, by training firefighters how to properly, safely, and operate fire apparatus, we've only hit really half the problem. And if you look state by state, how easy it is to get a driving license and what's the influence? Well, it's all about the money. State governments want every citizen to have a driving license so that they can pay sales tax and gas tax and registration fees and inspection fees. Make no mistake about it, you know, the state police in any given state aren't going to shut the roads down because or the governor of a state's not going to shut the roads down because the state police all of a sudden get a case of the blue flu and don't want to show up or write tickets. But the cry from any state capital after 3 days of a state police slowdown would be, where's the money? Where's the revenue? Where's the tickets? And so there are departments out there that have taken a series of steps with the public to train the public how to interact with emergency vehicles, Bowling Green, Kentucky certainly being one of them. After a very serious, almost fatal crash, they came up with a program called EVA, Emergency Vehicle Awareness. And to date in that city, they have trained over 15,000 civilian drivers through driver ed programs. The fire department has their 3-hour add-on program to that. Arrive Alive 55 classes, going to continuing education college in and around Bowling Green, where they train tractor trailer drivers and bus drivers and train people.
Did you just say Arrive Alive 55?
Yeah.
You're going to be eligible for that program in just a couple of years there. Okay.
Thank you for reminding
me.
Right. But
sign you up for that one.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are some, although very small pockets, there are firefighters out there trying to educate the country on how to interact with emergency vehicles, but it's something that is far lacking. I interacted with a firefighter from Germany, and just to drive a car in Germany, it requires 40 hours of driver training on the part of a civilian before you're allowed to drive a car in Germany, and maybe that will lead us to there. Jim?
Three quick comments. First of all, as people that are involved in manufacturing and sales, it's always our responsibility to meet the demands of our customers. And in the case of this market, I'd suggest that meeting the customer demand means listening to the desires and needs of a very diverse customer base and then responding to that. And secondly, as a function of doing that, I think another thing that's going to be important moving forward is the ability of manufacturers to cost-effectively package technology and capabilities. And third, and we've talked a lot about regulation today, as regulators, be they the government or be they the NFPA, look to try to regulate out certain sorts of issues, I think it's important that we always be aware of the law of unintended consequences. That is, that you do something and it results in consequences like you might not want. As an example, taking SCBAs out of the cab, when does that allow the bean counter to say, well, why don't you get a 2-door commercial and everybody else can follow down the road in a Suburban or a sedan? Be careful what you wish for. And you always have to make sure that you're not creating a problem that is worse than the one you attempted to solve.
Jim,
good point.
Very, very good points. Jason.
I think we're entering a very interesting time in the apparatus industry with the new NFPA coming out in 2009, with more engine changes coming in 2010, it's going to be a very interesting and exciting time, and there are a lot of challenges for us apparatus manufacturers to try and do exactly what we've heard here, keep the costs down, but still keep developing safety and how to work everything in. Some of the radical changes coming up, like the tilt table testing, the rollover prevention, the seatbelt indicators, all the way down to something that seems minor like chevrons, it's going to be interesting to see how we interact with the customer when they say, well, I didn't do that before, maybe I don't want that, but we all need to get on a common ground and try and make these safety things become the rule instead of the exception.
Very good. Jason, wrapping up here for this edition of the Apparatus Architect here, live from Baltimore, Maryland. We once again, finally, we'd like to thank Keith Purdy from American LaFrance, Jim Sommi from Crimson Fire, Alan Hollister from Emergency One, Jim Featherstone from Pierce, and Jason Whitmire from KME. I'd like to give these folks a round of applause here for helping us out this morning. All right.
And we'd also like to thank our sponsor, Task Force Tips, for once again sponsoring the Apparatus Architect. That's all from now from Baltimore. See you next time on the Apparatus Architects.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.